Okay, so I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for inviting me to speak after Andre. It's a pretty tough act to follow. So I'm going to talk about three papers, one older one with Daniel Bauman, and two more recent ones with a pretty long list of collaborators. Two of them spoke earlier today, Leonardo and Liam, so you might notice some significant overlap, but I will try to give a slightly different interpretation. Okay, so the plan is I'm first just going to quickly review the limits on non-Gaussianity from Planck, and then I'm going to discuss two ways of reinterpreting those. First, in terms of single field inflation and what it tells us about the mechanism of inflation. And then secondly, I'm going to just discuss how we might interpret this as bounds on the presence of extra degrees of freedom. And then I'll sort of conclude with some summary and maybe some interesting questions we can discuss now or through the rest of the conference. Okay, so the limits after Planck. So Planck reports, amongst other things, bounds on three templates. The local template here has local of 2 plus or 3 plus or minus 6. The shape that has a bound of f and l of minus 40 plus or minus 75, and the orthogonal shape, which is minus 25 plus or minus 40. Now, one of the things you might often hear as a common sentiment looking at these bounds is that they favor, perhaps strongly, a simple mechanism of inflation, or alternatively, that the data has ruled out exotic models of inflation. So the question I'd like to ask in this talk is, to what degree are these two statements true, and what is actually ruled out by the data? And in order to do that, you need sort of a better model-independent sense of what the size of f and l should have been that you're now ruling out. Okay, so let's start with the implications for single field inflation. Okay, so as Leonardo nicely reviewed, inflation is in some sense a theory of spontaneous breaking of time translations. So in some model independent sense, that means that there was an operator that acquired a time dependent vacuum expectation value that picks a preferred slicing. So there's a notion of time that's preferred where equal time corresponds to equal values of this operator. Like any model of spontaneous symmetry breaking, there's a Goldstone boson. And this Goldstone boson pi is what gives rise to the scalar fluctuations we observe in the CMB. And so it's the fluctuations of this Goldstone boson that we're constraining with Planck. Now, as Leonardo nicely emphasized, none of this framework required a fundamental scalar, and so it gives a really nice model-independent characterization of what we mean by inflation. So inflation is also a sort of picture of energy scales. There are two characteristic energy scales that are common to all models of inflation. There's the scale where the symmetry is broken that I'll denote f pi. You can think of this scale as in a slow roll model as being phi dot to the 1/2. The other scale is the energy scale at which we're actually probing these fluctuations, which is the inflationary Hubble scale. And the ratio of these two scales is always fixed by the overall power spectrum. So when you plug in the numbers, that tells you that f pi is 57 Hubble. So this is a sort of model-independent result that tells you how to think about inflation as just a ratio of energy scales. There's a background that lives at high energies. It spontaneously breaks a symmetry. And in between these two scales, you expect there's some effective theory for the fluctuations. So as Leonardo emphasized, what we're looking at when we study non-Gaussianity is constraints on new operators in the Lagrangian suppressed by some energy scale. And the question is, what is this energy scale, and where do these interactions become important in this picture of the energy scales relevant to inflation? Okay, so here are the results in the interest of time. So I've written two operators here. These are in the Planck papers. This is called EFT. This corresponds to the shape called EFT1, and this is called EFT2. If you can write it one way, where each operator is suppressed by a different energy scale. And the Planck limits tell us that these energy scales are bigger than, but not much bigger than, Hubble. So the constraint on lambda 1 is that lambda 1 is greater than 2.4 times Hubble. And the constraint on lambda 2 is that lambda 2 is greater than 0.9 times Hubble. So these are, compared to this 57, you might C are actually very low energy scales. We can write this a different way. Since this f pi, the scale at which the symmetry is broken, is basically the only scale in the problem for the pi's, it's natural to write these suppressed by the scale f pi and ask, what is this constraint on the dimensionless coefficient that sits in front of it? Using, again, the bounds from Planck, the constraint on C1 is that it's 30 plus or minus about 600, and the constraint on C2 is that it's 700 plus or minus 4,000. So you might have, again, guessed that these should have been order one numbers, so these constraints are again, surprisingly big. So what this implies for this picture of energy scales is if I put these scales right at the bounds of Planck, it tells me that the scale at which the theory becomes strongly coupled is just above the Hubble scale. There's a huge range of energies before the theory sort of the scale where the symmetry is spontaneously broken, between which the theory appears to be strongly coupled. Slow roll is a picture something like this. The background itself has some nice weakly coupled description. It's described in terms of a scalar field. We can use our normal field theory techniques to describe what happens. So that requires that the scale which this theory becomes strongly coupled is parametrically large compared to the scale phi dot where the symmetry is broken. And that's what we mean when we say that we can study slow roll models in sort of a perturbative framework. So that's a long way to go. There's a big range in energies here that would require an order 10 to 100 improvement on the bounds on the equilateral shape. So coming back to this question, does the model do these bounds strongly favor a simple mechanism, and has it ruled out all exotic possibilities? Well, it seems like there's still a big window in which exotic things could live. And so let's ask if there's some kind of example that might look exotic that could live in that window. So the simplest such example would just be that the theory is literally strongly coupled when described in terms of the background. But for the reasons Leonardo emphasized, the theory of the fluctuations is always weakly coupled for the usual reasons that theories of Goldstone bosons are. So in this picture, there would be no scalar field. And the theory would just become strongly coupled at the scale where the symmetry is broken. So there's QCD is a perfectly good example of this. In QCD, some quark bilinear acquires a vacuum exponentiation value that breaks the approximate chiral symmetry down to some diagonal vector symmetry. And the pions we observe are the pseudo-Goldstone bosons of this process. Now, to make the comparison with the bounds on here I've quoted what the measured value of, say, some four-derivative operator, which is essentially the analog of the operators we're measuring in the effective theory, is. And the number is order one. In fact, it's order one divided by this actually large numerical factor, so it's actually order one over 100 in the case of QCD. So here's an example where the dynamics of the background is obviously strongly coupled. There's no fundamental scalar in sight, but yet the prediction for what these higher derivatives operators are sort of order one times f pi. So we can imagine a model, although I don't know of one that exists, that has the following form. There's some quark bilinear that acquires a time-dependent expectation value that's sort of characterized by this scale f pi to the fourth that breaks the symmetry from the symmetries of De Sitter down to the symmetries on each spatial slice. Again, you might expect that the coefficients there are order one over f pi squared, which would correspond to f and l equilateral of order one. And this is going to be very challenging to measure in the near future, although large scale structure might provide some possibility. So the purpose of going through that first case was to contrast it with what happens when you include additional degrees of freedom. So to be most extreme, I'm going to consider the case where you have a slow roll model, which would on its own predict no measurable non-Gaussianity. And then I'm going to couple it to an additional scalar field we'll call sigma, where sigma is, again, a weakly coupled scalar. It has some potential. That potential is not of the slow roll type, so it may include somewhat large terms. But I'm going to assume that this theory is also weakly coupled, and we have some nice Lagrangian description of it. And then we'll just couple these two things together by some relatively innocuous looking operator, again, suppressed by some scale lambda. when you take this Lagrangian, now you expand it out in terms of the fluctuations, you get a quadratic Lagrangian of this form that looks like the coupling between a massless scalar field and a massive scalar field. So there's the massive scalar field, the massless scalar field, and this mixing interaction of the form phi dot sigma. Now, in this model, we'll assume that the sigma field has no role in the end of inflation, so the curvature perturbations are completely controlled by this field phi. The non-Gaussianity is controlled by two possible interaction terms. The first one is associated with this mixing interaction, is divided by the same scale lambda. And then there's a second one which is allowed just from the Lagrangian for sigma, some mu sigma cube type interaction. So the non-Gaussianity in this model is characterized by three scales: the mass of this extra field, the size of this cubic interaction, and this scale lambda, which is ultimately the one we're interested in putting bounds on. Now, as Liam discussed this morning, there's the natural sizes for these scales m and mu is of order of the Hubble scale, but we'll scan over these parameters. We'll get results that depend somewhat on these values, but we'll see that the bounds are there are good bounds in both cases. To understand why the non-Gaussianity can be large, one just looks at the sort of parametric size of non-Gaussianity in the sigma sector. The size of non-Gaussianity in the sigma sector is essentially controlled by mu over h. So when mu is order h, it's order one non-Gaussian. That non-Gaussianity is traded to the non-Gaussianity of the curvature perturbations at a suppression of this mixing interaction cubed. But this mixing interaction is not necessarily particularly small, and so you can get very large non-Gaussianity as a result. So there are two cases I'll discuss first. The first is a universal constraint, makes no assumption about the size of interactions for this additional scalar field sigma. In this case, the mixing interaction will become strong. It will work in the case where this phi dot over lambda is much bigger than the Hubble scale. Under these circumstances, the only interaction that matters is the one suppressed by lambda. And this gives rise to both equilateral and orthogonal type non-Gaussianity. So both those templates are relevant for constraining this model. What you find is that in this case, the lambda is required to be greater than 66 times h. And that's the bound from the equilateral template. Alternatively, you can consider the case where we take the more natural value of mu of order h. In this case, the bound will come from the sort of conventional case where the kinetic terms are just given by the usual ones. The mixing interaction will become perturbative, and we can just use Feynman diagrams to describe it. In this case, the dominant interaction will be this mu sigma cubed, and we'll find both local and equilateral type non-Gaussianity. So one thing to note at this point is that between these two cases, I've covered all three of the templates. So within this simple Lagrangian, we've generated all three of the standard templates that are probed, that were probed by WMAP and now by Planck. When you plug in the numbers, you get that in this case, lambda is constrained to be greater than 10 to the 5 times Hubble. And to quote the same result that Liam did this morning, when you translate Hubble into the tensor to scalar ratio, you can write this as a constraint on involving the tensor to scalar ratio and the Planck scale. So if this mu is of order h and we measure tensors, then this constrains lambda to be greater than the Planck scale. Now, just coming back to this number, in isolation, you might not have had a feeling about how big this 10 to the 5 is. But when you compared it to the single field constraints where this number was like 2, I hope you're impressed at how high this scale is. Now, for this model, you can actually parameterize it more generally. You can study various exclusion plots. So here is a sort of version of a constraint on the parameters of say two of the parameters for fixed m. So here, all these shaded regions have f and l greater than 10, and you see sort of as this ratio mu over h approaches 1, you're getting our 10 to 5 limit. But down here, you see this universal bound of about 10 to the 2. Now, you should also notice the sort of interesting shape to this thing. So one notices that if you were in here, you would have been excluded, but you can avoid the exclusion bounds by either increasing or decreasing lambda. And this is an unusual situation for effective theory. Normally, you think if you're constrained for a particular value of lambda, it will never help to lower the value of lambda. But because of the complicated dynamics of this particular model, you actually have weakened constraints in both directions. Now, this generalizes. You can imagine cooking up the similar-looking mixing interactions for a general hidden sector involving general operators of some dimension with some lambda, again, to the power of the dimension. And in this general setup, your constraint on lambda will go now like 10 to the 5 times Hubble, but with the 10 to the 5 to the 1 over the dimension of the operator. So when this dimension is, say, 1 or 2 or somewhere in between, this is a very strong constraint. But as you approach, say, delta 4, it starts to look more like our single field bounds. And this is what allows us, this is how you can think of the interpolation between the weakness of the single field bounds and the strongness of the multi-field bounds. The multi-field bounds are coming from the fact that when you add additional degrees of freedom, you're allowed to have these very low dimension operators that are involved in interactions, and such things don't exist in the single field context. Okay, so just to summarize, you can think of there are sort of two interpretations I presented here. The first was a bound on single field mechanisms, and I think it would be fair to say that those bounds are still fairly weak. We have a long way to go until we're reaching what you might have thought was the sort of natural size of non-Gaussianity. The opposite is true in the case where we have extra fields that are mixed with the fluctuations of the implotron. In that case, the bounds seem surprisingly high. In some cases, in the case where we measure tensor modes, it's as high as the Planck scale. So in this case, we're really getting very good insight into the possibility of mixing between, say, the inflationary sector and some extra sector with some scalar fields. So just to conclude, here's some open questions that we might discuss. One is, do we have a reason to forbid this idea that the background is strongly coupled? In the absence of a data reason, or perhaps there is a data reason to forbid this possibility, do we expect these 1 over f pi type suppressed higher dimension operators to just not be allowed for some principled reason? Alternatively, we might just ask, how well can the equilateral bounds improve? And this is something that Leonardo referred to earlier. Now, this also might have been a controversial statement, I might like to ask, is it fair for me to conclude that multi-field is at this time more constrained than single-field mechanisms? Because it certainly appeared that my bounds were much stronger when I added multiple degrees of freedom than if I restricted myself to just the Goldstone boson. Okay, that's all I had to say, so thank you.
Thanks for that very interesting talk. So I guess the speaker provided the questions here. So if there are answers or further questions.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by strongly coupled background. So this is presumably at a very high energy. I mean, at the Planck scale, everything's strongly coupled, I would imagine.
So I mean that, the example with QCD was what I had in mind. It's that you have a process of spontaneous symmetry breaking, and there's some operator that acquires a time-dependent vacuum expectation value, but that process is not due to a weakly coupled scalar field rolling on a potential, but perhaps some quark bilinear that acquires that vacuum expectation value inside some strongly coupled field theory.
Okay. You're always assuming that inflation starts at some scale well below the Planck scale, so gravity is classical.
So this is
and it's just a quantum field theory, which is strongly coupled.
Yeah, strongly coupled quantum field theory,
and
not
some condensate of that, which is forming the implotron.
Yeah, that was what I had in mind. Although the other possibility that the gravity is strongly coupled at the scale is also extremely interesting. But I had in mind the strongly coupled field theory, but within the context of gravity.
Okay, thank you.
Then, of course, you would expect huge tensor modes to be produced, right? If h squared is a water m Planck, if that's what you meant by gravity strongly coupled. So you could have strongly curved gravity, as in the string scale being separate from the Planck scale, but you wouldn't expect quantum effects to be important, right?
Well, so for that example, I think Skenderis and McFadden have some models where they claim that they can actually do inflation within the context of strongly coupled gravity. So I think the predictions for the size of the tensor modes actually requires a model. I'm not, I don't claim to have any model or understanding of when gravity is strongly coupled, which is why the statement was meant to be in field theory. But there are claims that such models exist and are consistent with data. But I will leave it to those authors to defend against your criticism.
There's an ancient theory, which in fact, in my view, is an extremely modern theory, which is goes back to Chebyshev and Mirkonov, which is that we should really be talking about phonons as the collective phenomena in inflation. And a phonon is not a fundamental field, or you could say it's the most fundamental field, but it isn't. And it may satisfy some of these things. The other field, which is extremely interesting, is the log A, and the combination makes a nonlinear version of zeta. And what I'd be interested in is to actually seeing how this effective field theory maps into an effective hydrodynamics, and obviously, you know, sound speed and all of that, you're essentially mapping into that space. Has anybody done that exercise?
So I think in some part this was covered by, there's a paper by Nicholas and collaborators on something called solid inflation, where there really is something, it is like a solid, it has the equation of... So their effective theory for a solid is actually continuously connected to the fluid. So you can take the fluid as a special case of their solid. And there, it is really true that there is literally a phonon that characterizes the scalar fluctuations. And it's that phonon that becomes the curvature perturbation.
And just as a follow-up, and this is related to Andrei Frolov's earlier question in terms of this class of models, story you gave, which had the three cases for the non-Gaussianity, can one do an extension of that in a simple way that we could end up using that for preheating calculations so that one is going beyond the effective field theory description as it's given? This is Eva's response to that was yes, but you have to include a lot of higher order time operators. Do you see any prospect of that? Because it would be good from our perspective.
In principle, there's no reason it couldn't be applied to preheating or reheating, but I haven't looked into the specifics. But it, in terms of the symmetries and what you do, it seems like it's a loud possibility.
Yeah, let me comment one analogy with this hydrodynamics. I think pretty much this pi is basically hydrodynamics, and in particular, the statement that when the sound speed is smaller than the speed of light, you get large non-Gaussianities, which is what we've learned from here. They are coming in this hydrodynamic description by the term you cannot get rid of, which is the V grad V in the Euler equation, which is nonlinear, has to be there by Galilean invariance, which when it's non-relativistic is this Lorentz invariance that they're talking about. So this V grad V term is the FNL 1 over sound speed squared. It's trivial. I can do it if you want later. But it's the same.
Actually, I don't want this to be an ongoing dialogue here, but I think I recall that one of the things that you effective people, in all senses of the word, have done, which is that you mentioned viscosity effects.
Yeah.
And so what do you mean it's the same? But this is not appearing in effective field theory at this particular level that it's being used. In what way does the viscosity effectively manifest itself?
So, yeah, go ahead. Well, Matthias is, I think, fairly can answer that since he is one of the authors.
You can write examples in which you would additionally have viscosity, and they also lead to large non-Gaussianities for similar reason as the V grad V term. Well, for having dissipation, you need to have some other degrees of freedom. You cannot have all these theories would, you know, have a conservation of energy and stuff like that. You have to have more, exactly. That's how you do it, yeah.
That's
what you do. So you can store a lot of these
So in the equations of motion, it looks like a viscosity, but they have to, at the level of the Lagrangian, to write a Lagrangian with dissipation requires actually writing extra degrees of freedom, since it's not allowed if you just write one degree of freedom.
Actually, can I ask a question related to this and your last point? I mean, we know of multiple field situations where the fields are either only temporarily light or they're conformally coupled or whatever, such that they produce equilateral rather than local non-Gaussianity. And so it's hard to constrain that in the same way it's hard to constrain the single field.
Oh, so you mean the last point?
Yeah,
or the,
yeah.
Okay, so.
Yeah.
So to determine that it is multi-field is a different story. Even in those contexts, the constraint from equilateral, this 10 to the 5 isn't affected by the relative size of the local versus local bound from Planck. It's really to do with the size of non-Gaussianity you expect in those models being just dramatically different. So even if you just have even if it produces an equilateral shape in both cases, as an interpretation in terms of just the Goldstone boson, to generate an equilateral shape with large FNL requires a much lower energy scale being involved than if it's a multi-field example where it would be much easier to generate that size of FNL for a much higher energy scale coupling. Does that make sense?
I think you're agreeing that it's easy to produce equilateral non-Gaussianity with additional fields, and so it's hard to constrain that.
I agree it's easy to generate equilateral, yes.
Okay.
I think because we think that the FNL equilateral we can probe, maybe that's why you are waiting. Now, I wanted to add a comment for Dick, that is reheating. The only thing that changes is that the operator like H dot, H double dot, they're not pi square, they're no more suppressed. So you will have a bunch of more operators to consider, but you can easily do. You will have a model independent description for the inflaton sector of reheating. The only problem is that I don't see the complication of the reheating being simplified by this approach. It's complicated, and I suspect it will remain complicated. And then I had a question for Dan. That is, these constraints on multi-field is really when you mix directly with the inflaton, with the specific coupling that is, for example, if you put a derivative.
There are constraints on multi-field that are interacting during inflation,
yeah,
as opposed to just affecting the end of inflation, but have no coupling. But
yeah, those are very highly unconstrained right
now.
Those
are unconstrained. But on the other hand, even if you said those fields were around, you still have to impose the constraint. The fact that there's a constraint that says they do not mix with the inflationary sector, because the operators I wrote down are allowed by every symmetry in the problem. There's no way to forbid them just at the level of symmetries. No, they're shift symmetric. You have to have a shift symmetry for the other field, but then why?
The field. No, I just make the other field shift symmetric.
Okay, but why does it affect? Okay.
But it's okay. No, I think it's really. I wasn't complaining.
Yeah,
I'd say
okay.
That, of course, you can make it. If you make the other field shift symmetric, the bound is going to diminish.
But that's not necessarily true. I mean, it. You just have to have that O be some shift symmetric operator. So your question is, what is the allowed space of operators for that other sector? Now, again, in some cases, the allowed operators might be dimension 4 or greater, and then the bounds look the same. But it depends on details.
Sorry, can I try and ask my question again? Because
okay.
It's something you know very well, and I'm still confused by the answer. If you have something like trapped inflation, where the field, there are multiple fields there,
yep,
but there's not an effective field theory treatment that includes all of that yet, and they don't produce isocurvature or these kinds of contributions, it just behaves in effect like a single field model where the interactions are slowing the field down and you get non-Gaussianity that's equilateral. Would you regard that as constrained more like the single field examples or constrained more like the multiple field examples? That was my question.
The examples of dissipation, of which trapped inflation is an example, are sufficiently different in a number of details that we'd have to revisit the analysis. I'm not sure. So it's because the power spectrum is modified by the fact that there's a viscosity, and that, so a lot of the details that went into the bounds apply for don't apply to that case. So I'm not actually sure.
Effective field theory hasn't been completely general in that sense.
So I think they would claim to have. So the viscosity paper would cover that case. I don't think they've actually. I think some of the parts of that paper make assumptions that are not completely true of trapped inflation, but in principle, what they do could be extended to cover trapped inflation.
Okay, thanks. I may not be up on the latest. Any more questions?
I think we will never rule out multi-field inflation. but single field inflation has its own beauty due to its simplicity. I would agree with Andre on that. That's like the standard model with only one Higgs. And this has stand all observations so far. And the only little point I would make for single field inflation, if you really have it, then it's difficult to produce the beauty spot on Andre's figure, because asymmetries are typically absent in single field inflation.
So the comparison with the Higgs, you might say, I'm certainly in favor of arguments for simplicity, but on the theoretical side. But before the LHC discovered the Higgs, you might have, some group of people would have said precision electroweak tests favor a light Higgs anyway. That even though we haven't directly observed it, there's evidence in the data that strongly supports the idea that we do have a light scalar degree of freedom and it's not Technicolor. Now, the question that I was trying to pose in this talk was, are we in that situation in cosmology yet when it comes to single field inflation? I think both Leonardo and I were sort of making this analogy, and I think we're not quite at, our equivalent of precision electroweak is not sensitive enough that we could say it's, you know, regardless of taste regarding model building, the data supports a single weakly coupled scalar.
So I had two questions. The first one is probably naive, but if a single field model is strongly coupled at the Hubble scale, then can you trust the usual tree level calculation of the three-point function?
If it's strongly coupled at the Hubble scale, no. But we're not strongly coupled at the Hubble scale, so that's guaranteed by the bounds of non-Gaussianity could be just reinterpreted as saying it is weakly coupled at the Hubble scale. It's just that the scale at which it actually does become strongly coupled is not very far away. So it's strongly coupled at Hubble, but it's weakly coupled at Hubble, but it's strongly coupled at a few times Hubble. So that's more or less what these bounds say.
I thought you had a Planck constraint that was like 0.9.
So that's where factors of pi matter. So so it's true that the constraint on the scale that appears below, so I can go back. So the constraint was this. So you're thinking of this 0.9H.
Yeah.
But when you translate that into the scale where it becomes strongly coupled, on this plot I put the square root of 4 pi because that's sort of where, that's where loops become order 1, and so that's where it actually becomes strongly coupled. So there's a slight mismatch between what scale appears in this operator and where the theory actually becomes strongly coupled, and that's important for making this picture make sense. Because otherwise, if you just said it's strongly coupled at this scale lambda, then you're right. We wouldn't be able to trust our predictions. But that would be in contradiction to the fact that it looks very weakly coupled from the fact that the perturbations appear to be Gaussian.
The second question is, can you go back to the plot with the allowed regions in the quasi-single field inflation plane?
This one?
Yeah, I was just sort of curious about this is an interesting plot. Like, what's whether you could interpret these wiggles or what's going on with like there's like a magic direction.
So this direction. I can explain. I didn't explain this direction, but thank you for asking. So what's happening in this direction is you're essentially there's something slightly wrong with this plot, which is that FNL here is defined the way most people do, which is by the precise value in the equilateral. In the exact equilateral shape, what is the amplitude of the three-point function? Now, in this limit, you have essentially minus mu. You have two interactions that have opposite sign, and they're just exactly canceling in the equilateral configuration there. But what that tells you is this corner is orthogonal. So this region here is actually more constrained by orthogonal. So here I've just simplified the plot by plotting FNL equilateral, or FNL as defined by the value in the equilateral. In exact equilateral point, but in practice what we should do is some more integrated definition of non-Gaussianity, and then this region would also be would be more obviously excluded, but it is excluded down here as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank all the morning speakers again.